We're going to get started. Amy MacArthur is our first speaker. Amy MacArthur is a graduate student at the University of Texas, earning a Master's of Science in Information Studies with an emphasis on archives and preservation. She also holds a BFA in Painting and English from the University of Houston. Much of her graduate studies have been devoted to the impacts of preservation barriers, such as copyright restrictions and technological obsolescence on collections development, preservation policy, and access regarding time-based media. She currently works at the Harry Ransom Center in Austin, Texas, as a film and video digitization technician working with literary and performing arts collections, and at the Texas Archive of the Moving Image as a digitization intern preserving home movies and other amateur films. In June, she will be leaving for New York, where she will be interning at the Whitney Museum of American Arts Library and Archives, and where, as part of her internship, she will be developing a preservation plan for the archival audiovisual materials in the Whitney's holdings. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you, guys. I'm going to try very hard not to stare at my notes the whole time. I'm a little bit nervous. And I'm going to start this so that I don't run over for the rest of everyone. So a little bit of introduction. My talk today is Oral Histories from Houston's Andrews Studios, a Use Case in Scalar. In 2009, Walt Andrus passed away in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, leaving the remaining audio recordings from his career as producer and sound engineer to Frank Davis, his friend and once employee. His widow, Lynn Gray, drove the recordings from the New Mexico deserts to an old brick warehouse in Houston's Little White Oak Bayou, where Frank was living amidst mosquitoes, humidity, and an accumulation of acoustic instruments and electronic equipment that he had amassed over the course of his life as an artist, inventor, sound engineer, and musician. It was at this warehouse that I first met Frank in the same year. At the time, I was performing my own music and was very interested in early noise and psychedelic bands such as the Red Crayola, who Frank had recorded and produced in 1968. Weeks passed, and I found myself returning again and again to the warehouse, often to be regaled by Frank's stories of local musicians and artists of the 1960s and 70s. During these visits, I would always try to coax Frank into letting me listen to his recordings. One day, he finally brought a laundry basket of audio reels out from the recesses of the warehouse, and which gave off a plume of dust when he set them before me. I insisted that he let me clean and digitize the reels, which were obviously in a very poor state. And in response, he showed me a wall of cabinets that contained the several hundred audio reels that Walt had bequeathed to him. He asked me to do something. At the time, I had no preservation experience, but I resolved to do what I could. With the help of fellow musician David File, I inventoried the tape stocks, sizes, and information written on the tape's boxes, and used this information to write a grant proposal. And in 2011, David and I received an Idea Fund grant to digitize the tapes. We then hired sound engineer Rock Romano to train us on the process of digitizing analog sound. Rock had also been an engineer at Andrews Studios and was a wonderful resource for both the technical aspects and historical aspects of the project. A little bit of background information about Andrews Studios for those of you who haven't heard of it. Before opening Andrews Studios, Walt Andrus worked as in radio production for stations in Port Arthur, New Orleans, and Mobile, Alabama. In 1963, having returned to Houston, he was hired as a production engineer at Gold Star Recording Studios, where he earned a reputation for producing custom recordings of blues and soul artists for Don Robey's Duke and Peacock record labels. recording artists such as Bobby Bland, Junior Parker, and Ernie K. Doe. Andrus recordings of Willie Nelson's Funny How Time Slips Away with soul singer Joe Hinton rose to number 13 on Billboard's Hot 100 chart in 1964. But the recording industry in Houston was volatile, and after being abruptly dismissed from Gold Star on Christmas Eve, Walt decided to go into business for himself. Let's see here. And in 1966, he opened Andrus Studios. The interior of the studio at 3204 Broadway was designed and built by Andrus and his father, as was much of the equipment. According to himself, Frank Davis walked into Andrus Studios during its construction with no experience, but looking for a job. The parts of a reel-to-reel deck were spread on the floor. Walt told Frank that if he could put together the machine, he would have a job. After successfully assembling the deck, Frank became the engineer at the studio until 1970. Andrus Studios is perhaps best known for recording seminal Texas psychedelic bands such as the 13th Floor Elevators and other bands on the International Artist record label. However, while psychedelic music became its claim to fame, the studio also recorded revivalist folk, pop, soul, garage, and southern rock, as well as community theater performance and even radio commercial spots for pirate station Radio London. The Andrus Studios materials thus serve to document both the psychedelic bands that achieved cult status, as well as the larger swath of Houston's creative output at the time. The audio reels in the Andrus collection consist of masters, safeties, and listening copies. Our initial inventory covered 469 reels on 1-inch, 1/2-inch, and 1/4-inch tape. However, that number has been somewhat augmented by other recordings that were gifted to the project. Some of the recordings pre- and post-date the operations of Andrus Studios when Walt was working as a freelance producer, and there's a smaller collection of Frank Davis's recordings from the studio, at home, and live performances elsewhere. Our initial plan when David and I applied for the grant was to digitize recordings and make them and their histories accessible online in something like a wiki format. This proved to be much more difficult than we anticipated. One of the first problems we encountered was the general lack of information about the recordings on the boxes that housed them, the small bits of information that we actually had. The box on the screen is actually an example of one of the more descriptive cases in the collection. Often there would be only the name of the band featured on the recording, and sometimes not even that. The literature we were able to locate on this area of Houston's history was also sparse and tended to pool around particular artists and labels that had attained notoriety at the time. Finally, the bulk of the recordings were fixed before 1972, and there was no easy way to track down whether recordings had been published, when or by whom. This meant that obtaining permissions for any kind of access would be difficult, if not impossible. As a result, I started seeking out musicians, recording engineers, and other people associated with the studio to record interviews of their stories and the general history of the music scene at the time. What I found was that there were many people interested in sharing these stories. The interviews were largely unstructured and have a very familiar tone about them. I shied away from directing the course of the narratives, allowing the information to unfold according to what the interviewee thought was important rather than imposing any of my own values or perceptions. I also digitized photographs and ephemera that the interviewees would bring along. During this time, it also occurred to me that these interviews and visual materials might serve the access functions that had originally been envisioned for the music recordings. With this in mind, I included language in the interview releases about display and distribution online. Okay. Once several of these interviews had been conducted, the task became to design a digital space for them to inhabit. A professor at UT encouraged me to try using Scalar, a new digital authoring tool. Scalar was developed by the Alliance for Networking and Visual Culture, and is an open source rich media platform for academic long form authoring and publication. Scalar supports assembling various kinds of media from multiple sources into both linear and non-linear texts. Scalar has many preset templates, but can also be customized. And for myself, having a little bit of coding experience and a lot of material to structure, the combination of pre-made and customizable elements was a great fit. So on the right side of the screen are a couple of screenshots of the Scalar exhibit as it exists right now. It still is a bit in process, and I am still gathering interviews. But the top portion, you can see the interview transcripts aligned on the right side of the screen and the other visual and sonic materials on the left side. These are actually queued up so that when you access each interview, it'll start you at the beginning and then have links between content on the textual side and on the visual side. Scalar also allows you to develop annotations for your media and text at specific points. So for instance, if a particular picture has to do with a particular part of the transcription, it will cue it up to that part of the media, and you can click on it, and it will start from that part of the conversation. And Scalar also has a functionality for supporting pathways through the media so that the interviews themselves can be navigated in and out, tracing out various different locations and musical encounters that are shared between the interviewees. Okay. Yet to come are more interviews seeking permissions to provide clips of the materials and depositing the Andrus collection and the Scalar exhibit with an appropriate repository. Right. I know I kind of sped through that. Does anyone have any questions?
So did you finally digitize all this material?
Not all, but over 400 of the reels have been digitized at this point.
And what type of music? I mean, you mentioned the general categories, but did you find out who the specific bands were and their song titles and all that?
Many of them, yes, but there are still some gaps, and I'm hoping that future interviews will address some of those gaps.
But I mean, the tapes obviously were in pretty good shape, weren't they? Because this is stuff from the 60s and 70s when tapes were perfectly good.
Well, I would say that probably a third of the tapes were on polyester stock, and of those, there were a portion that had sticky shed syndrome, and there were some tapes from Frank Davis's collection that had brittleness from drying out. But in general, you're correct that many of the tapes were in very good condition, and the recordings sound very nice.
It was drying out in Houston, is hard to imagine.
I think it had to do with the dust that had settled on the tapes. Many of them did not have casings, and so the dust kind of wicked away the moisture and caused them to become brittle. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
When you said the interviews online, you showed them in a transcript form. Do you offer an audio?
Yes, and I'll backtrack a little bit. Sorry, I didn't mean to breeze through it so much. It's partly just me being nervous. Let's see if I can zoom in. All right, so if you can see here, the transcript is on the right side. This is an audio clip of the entire interview, and it's hosted. No, I should have zoomed in on it, yeah. It's hosted through SoundCloud. There are a number of different media supports that you can integrate into Scalar. You also can upload things directly to Scalar, But what I found was that the interviews were so long that they were always over the limit for the amount of information that you could upload. So that was why I chose SoundCloud instead. Yes?
So you said that the interviews were also annotated and comments. Is that done through SoundCloud's interface, or is that separate?
That's actually through Scalar. And let me see if I can back off a little. Now, this isn't so much the annotation as it is the paths, but each of these is a section of transcript that's been annotated, and it also has visual materials that are linked to it. So as far as like kind of teasing out the commonalities between the different interviews and whatnot, you can kind of see how those are done in different strands. And this is in the main menu, so you have each interview in the main menu and also the paths between them. So you can pull up this visualization, and each one of those nodes will take you to that annotation. Yes?
I was wondering where you digitized them, whether it was through your institution or how you secured the equipment.
That was a piecemeal process. The first portion of the collection was digitized at Rock Romano's studio. It's in the Heights in Houston. It's a pretty small, it's in a garage, it's a small studio. But he did have quarter-inch reel-to-reel equipment and all the digital equipment that we needed, AD converters and whatnot. So that was the beginning, and there were quite a few quarter-inch tapes in the collection. So we started out there and then moved onwards. It took me quite a while to find a one-inch machine, a one-inch 8-track machine that was in functioning condition that I could get access to with the budget that I had, which was quite small. But fortunately, I found Church House Studios in Austin, and they essentially set aside a room for me to use with their one-inch machine. I brought the rest of the equipment myself, and over the course of a week, transferred 96 one-inch reels. And after that, there was a musician in Houston who had a half-inch machine, and he basically just loaned it to us. We gave him some money, but he was really kind and loaned us the equipment to do those tapes as well.
Who transcribed the interviews, and how long did that take?
That was me. That was me, and it's very time-consuming. I would say that the process of transcribing the interviews and scanning all of the images, which I scanned at a preservation quality and then had to run a script on to get them small enough to upload to Scalar, all of that was very time-consuming. And I think that having done it, I would probably want to design a workflow so that all of those steps are taken care of at one time, rather than realizing that I would have to go back and make changes and keep adapting the material to fit the environment that it's going into. But that being said, the platform itself actually is very user-friendly. All the recordings are backed up three different times on hard drives right now. And I've spent the last semester researching repositories that would be appropriate for the collection. I don't know if I really can say much more than that, other than that I'm kind of liaising between the owner of the collection and a repository right now.
We still have a little bit of time.
Yes?
I was going to ask, will the digitized recordings eventually live, or do they live on this Scalar platform along with the orchestras and visual materials, or are those going to kind of be separate?
Well, essentially, the conclusion that I came to whenever I really examined what the rights issues were with the recordings and how little information there was just about who actually owned those rights, whether it was musicians that appeared on the recordings, record labels, et cetera, I kind of backed away from the idea of trying to host them online. I have since been given a quantity of administrative documents from the studio that actually give a lot of clues to what those would be. And I'm interested in tracking down permissions on specific pieces within the collection. A lot of them are not really of commercial value even. Some of them are art performances that had soundtracks that went with them, things of that nature that are indicative of things that were going on at the time but aren't necessarily suited to a commercial release. But that's kind of still, that's one of the next steps. Yes, sir.
I'm just curious, because the Lightning Hopkins thing, you should be able to find the LP that material comes from. I'm not sure whether the entire session was issued or not, and I think the same thing with the 13th floor elevator people.
So
you should find those LPs and just compare what tracks are used on them.
So one of the things about this collection is that it is not the entirety of Andrus Studios' production. Those, especially recordings like Lightning Hopkins and 13th Floor Elevators that were very successful, resided with the labels, and we don't have very much. There's actually no Lightning Hopkins material, and the one 13th Floor Elevators recording that we have was actually recorded over with a soul session, and so it's not useful. So that's really unfortunate. So it's not the entirety of what Andrus Studios produced, but it is a fair swath of that. And there, you're correct that there are certain artists that are easier to track down, especially if the material was released. The ambiguity is where we have materials that we're not sure if they were ever released, and we don't know who would have released them because we're not quite certain who the artist is. So that's kind of still yet to be seen. Thank you very much.